Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco's oldest and by far most innovative public radio station.
Continuing conversations that begin at the most beautiful spot on the Stanford campus, Philosopher's Corner.
Yeah, it's a really lovely spot, and it's quite inspirational for our conversation today, John, because we're going to talk about beauty.
Beauty. Beauty. You know, what is beauty?
Beauty's in the eye of the beholder. That's what they told me a long time ago, John.
Yeah, but you're such a rationalist, you probably don't believe that. But I think beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I think, that is to say, I would define beauty as something like that which brings enjoyment to the person who looks or contemplates. And that makes it subjective, because enjoyment is something that's not in the object, but in the beholder. Right. Not necessarily in the eye, but the brain or the mind or somewhere along those lines.
I think you're being a little too quick here, because, you know, I think of red, seeing red. Some people think of that as subjective. Well, you know, I have to have the right kind of eyes and the right kind of brain to see red. But once I have the right kind of eyes and the right kind of brain, well, I see red because red is there. It's in the thing. It's objective. And beauty's like that, too. I've got the right kind of equipment, the right kind of training. I see the beautiful. I mean, you know, it's right to see that thing is beautiful because there's something about it.
Well, let's toss out some philosophical terminology here. Let's say the property is subjective if it requires subjects of the right sort to make any difference. So red is like that. If there weren't creatures around with eyes and visual systems like us, objects wouldn't be red. Or if they would, no one would know it. I think beauty is more subjective than that. I think beauty is a little more like the taste of lima beans or like the pleasure that one does or doesn't get. I don't like lima beans. When I eat lima beans, I don't like the effect they have on me. And I think beauty is like that. And so it's doubly subjective. We wouldn't expect everyone to agree about lima beans, and we shouldn't expect everyone to agree about which things are beautiful.
But you don't think that when you say something's beautiful, you're not recommending it, you're just saying, well, I like it, I take delight in it. Aren't you in any way recommending to others that they should take delight in it too?
Okay, I agree with you there. It's a more interesting property than liking lima beans. If I think something's beautiful, that says something a little deeper about me, and therefore I expect other people that are similar to me, people with whom I'd like to carry on a conversation, people that share other values, I expect them to agree with me. So it's a little bit intersubjective. I'll go along with that.
But okay, I've got you a little bit toward the at least intersubjective. What about objectivity? You don't think there's anything about the object that, as it were, commands this delight from you? You don't think there's anything about the object, about the beautiful sunset, about the finely structured painting that commands your delight?
I think your hero Kant said you couldn't come up with a bunch of concepts such that every object to which they applied was either beautiful or not beautiful. So no, I don't think it's objective in that sense.
Yeah. Well, then how can... But do you think... Can there be an argument about what's beautiful? I mean, can I say, that's beautiful and you disagree, and can we have any rational argument about it?
I don't know. That's a good question. We're getting pretty philosophical here. I wonder if the way we're using beauty has anything to do with the way ordinary people
use
beauty.
Why don't we find out? Why don't we ask the folks out there for some examples of beauty? And you know who did that? Our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, on whom we can always count. She filed this report.
So what is beauty? Go out on the street and you'll find that there's not exactly a consensus.
Flowers, the ocean.
A 6-foot wave, someplace warm with no one out.
Beauty is wonderful flowers, sun, nice weather.
You are so beautiful.
Seeing all the colors, nice people who are happy, that all is beauty for me.
To me.
It could be the ocean. It could be a bird.
It's a lot about community and community building.
Beauty is something that doesn't cost any money at all. That is sunshine, blue sky, and good health.
Beauty is the look in the eyes of your child at 6 in the morning, the warmth of their hand.
It's a beautiful woman smiling at me. There you go. That's beauty.
To me.
Beauty, I think, is something that would make you feel very much alive and would make you smile.
It brings about a sense of pleasure.
It's the feeling that I feel inside. It kind of puts me at ease, makes me happy.
It's just a calming. It makes me feel very calm.
I guess the common denominator is freedom.
I think it's the representation of what we think is good in life.
Yeah, makes me feel happy, I guess. That's it.
Happiness.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
I'm John Perry here with Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're discussing beauty. And that was a very interesting set of comments. Ken, I sit here, I look at you, you are so beautiful to me.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, it's not just skin deep, your mind, your concern about others, your knowledge of the great people in history. And then I try to say, now, what effect are you having on me that makes me say you're beautiful? Is it because you make me happy, or is it because you make me feel the freedom, or is it because you represent everything that's good? Those are interesting suggestions, but, you know, probably somebody knows more about this than me.
Yeah, that's always the case. And, you know, we've got one of those people here. We've got an expert on beauty and a consumer and lover of beauty. That's Alexander Nehemas. He's a professor of philosophy and comparative literature at Princeton University. He's author of lots of cool things, including, I think, his most recent book is The Art of Living, Socratic Reflections from Plato to Foucault. And I understand Alexander is working on a book on beauty even as we speak. Alexander, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much for having me, gentlemen.
Hi, Alexander. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Hello, John. Thank you for inviting me.
Alexander, some people say that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, or that others put it out on the skin, and they say it's only skin deep. So it can't be both skin deep and in the eye of the beholder, unless we're talking about the skin of the eye of the beholder. I'm totally confused about beauty. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I think everybody is confused about beauty, and that includes me. There are no experts in beauty. I think that that's one of the most interesting and most fascinating and I think most wonderful things about it, when you're listening to what various people think beauty is, according to your own roving reporter. It was a fascinating experience for me. But I would like to think a bit about your idea of beauty being skin deep and beauty being in the eye of the beholder. Those are very common ideas that we have. And when we say, I think, when we say that beauty is skin deep, we mean that you can't tell from the fact that a person or an object is beautiful very much else about them. You can't tell whether a person is good or kind or intelligent or witty or capable in one way or another just from the fact that they are beautiful. What's interesting about that, though, is that you could substitute for are beautiful also look beautiful. If somebody looks beautiful, you can't tell much about them.
Well, so wait a minute, though, Alexander. If somebody looks beautiful, I mean, if they have a beautiful face or a beautiful figure, you can't tell much about their character or their soul or their mind. But if they have a beautiful mind or a beautiful character, doesn't that make them something really special? And not, I mean, the beauty that's only skin deep is not is a beauty of a surface thing rather than a beauty of a thing that's beneath the skin.
Let me jump in here. I think I read in something you wrote, Alexander, that for lots of uses of beauty, we could just say pretty.
Right.
It's prettiness that's skin deep. But that's philosophers, right, at least, and the people in our roving philosophical reporter's report, too, have a more deep sense of beauty that they also use, that pretty doesn't capture at all. Prettiness is
exactly
skin deep.
That's absolutely. The idea is that prettiness, which is skin deep, which is, of course, one way of which in which people talk about beauty, is in fact not, I would say, in the eye of the beholder. That kind of beauty, the beauty that, say, supermodels or whatever are supposed to have, is beauty that psychologists have more or less investigated pretty well. And from what I understand, they seem to think that there's quite a lot of agreement about it, not only within a particular culture, but among different ones. On the other hand, there is the beauty that, as you characterize it, is much deeper. And about that beauty, I think, there's very little agreement. And that is, for that reason, in my view, in the eye of the beholder.
Oh,
so either one or the other.
So you think if it's deep beauty, it's in the eye of the beholder. In the eye of the beholder, and if it's shallow beauty, it's not in the eye of the beholder.
Exactly, which may be a bit counterintuitive.
Somewhat paradoxically, prettiness is more objective than beauty, on your view.
That's what I think.
But I think I agree with you.
I think I probably agree with you, but I mean, people say these things, that standards of, say, female beauty, you know, vary from culture to culture, even over the short term. Look at movie stars of the 1940s versus movie stars of the 70s versus movie stars now, you know, and...
Sure.
You know, and thin came in at some point, and sort of muscular beauty, you know.
But when they do controlled studies, I think they find, even though it varies from culture to culture, what's particular features are considered beautiful. Usually it's kind of the average.
Exactly.
It's the features that are most average and those that's most nearest the mean for the people. And that's pretty objective.
It's pretty objective, and it has a good evolutionary explanation, because averageness in general suggests that you are in the middle of your group, which means that less evolutionary pressure is going to be exerted on you from the sides.
Wait a minute, you have
a better chance to survive.
I thought things of great beauty were outstanding things, not average things.
That's one of the counterintuitive consequences of this interpretation. But why don't we move to what we called deep beauty before and try to contrast the two?
Right.
Now, very often when we talk about this other beauty, the beauty that includes personality or happiness or goodness or freedom or community or all the various things that people who were interviewed mention, we think that this, unlike the prettiness that we talked about before, has very little, perhaps even nothing to do with a person's appearance. And I think that's actually also not true in the following way. We talk about inner beauty, namely, say, the personality, someone's personality. I believe that if you find someone's personality attractive in whatever way, that particular way in which they are attractive, say because they're generous, kind, and humorous, will in fact color their physical features, their facial and bodily features for you. You will perceive their kindness, their humorousness in the way they bear themselves, in the look of their eyes, in the smile that they have every now and then, in the turn of a head. And in that way, I think, there is no clear distinction between inner and outer beauty.
Well, I think it's a very good point, and I believe, again, in something you wrote, you use that as an explanation for the fact that you can have friends that are gaga over some person and just think that they're absolutely stunning, and you can't really see it at all. And
for the life of you.
Yeah. So it's not like the taste of lima beans. It's subjective, but it's an interactive subjectivity, much more complicated.
But I want to ask both of you, I'll set up a question, and maybe we can dig into it in a little bit later after the break. But look, when I say something's beautiful, mm-hmm. I'm not just commenting on my response to it. I'm not just saying, I like you, because if I like you, I love you, I think you're terrific, because I could just say those things. When I say, it's beautiful, and I declare it to the world, I'm saying, look with me, and see with me the beauty of this thing. And if somebody disagrees, I say, well, wait a minute, look at it this way, look at it that way, look at it from this angle. I mean, see how this feature of it. So I'm not just, I'm not sure about this deep beauty being in the eye of the beholder, because when I recommend something as beautiful, I recommend it to all observers, don't I?
To all observers? Everybody?
Well-situated observers.
Well, but that's very important, isn't it? I mean, that it's not everyone. I mean, that's what Kant said, right? That when you say that something is beautiful, he says, you impute agreement to everyone. In other words, you think that everyone, if you're right, everyone should agree with you.
Alexander, I'm going to let you dispute Kant in a few seconds. I'll remind our listeners that you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We are talking about the nature of beauty with Alexander Nehamis of Princeton University.
Coming up, we'll take your comments and questions, and we're going to start to consider the varieties of beauty. What does a beautiful work of art have in common with a beautiful person? Or what people tell me are beautiful mathematical proofs. Excuse me for giggling. Is beauty one thing or many? We'll take your calls after the break.
And remember, you can check out our new blog where Alexander already joined us for more discussion of this subject. The address of that blog is www.theblog.philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk will be right back. The Temptations with Beauty is Only Skin Deep. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Got some questions for you, our audience. What does a beautiful painting have in common with a beautiful song, or a beautiful proof, if there are such things, or a beautiful person, or a beautiful bit of nature? What's the essential quality that all these things share, if there's any such thing that they share?
Now, you can reach us in the Bay Area at 415-841-4134. I'll repeat, 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, toll-free, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or finally, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
And you can do that from anywhere in the world. So anybody, people listening over in Japan and Germany, I know you listen over there. Send us an email. Our guest is Professor Alexander Naamas of Princeton University, author of The Art of Living, Socratic Reflections from Plato to Foucault. Alexander, before the break, you were going at Kant. I said, look, when I call something beautiful, I'm not just reporting on my own response to it. I'm saying to the world, look at it and respond to it this way, because that's an appropriate response. And you were.
I was more or less agreeing with you, though I wouldn't go quite as far as Kant, and I don't know whether you would agree with him or not on that. Kant thought that if we think something is beautiful, we want everyone to agree with us. I think John is more nearly right when he said earlier that when you say that something is beautiful, you're saying that people who are like you, people whom you respect, people whose taste you admire, people you don't know but you would like to know, are going to agree with you, or you hope will agree with you. And by contrast, if somebody you don't like at all likes something, you'll start questioning whether you are right to like it in the first place or whether to find it beautiful, so to speak.
Well, I'm not sure I followed everything you said, because when I heard that John was more nearly right than Kant, I kind of, my mind just went, you know.
Good to say that.
It's true. Usually when you stand on the shoulders of giants, you just kind of see a lot of dandruff, but occasionally you get it. Occasionally you get a good idea.
He was wearing a wig, remember?
That's right. Well, maybe that's why giants should wear wigs. Anyway, we digress. Let me go back to this odd, to me, odd notion of the beauty of mathematical proofs. Now, I giggled at that when I said it before the break, but there's no doubt that mathematicians do have a lot of intersubjective agreement about which proofs are beautiful and which not.
Absolutely.
They surely can't expect everyone to agree with them. I mean, they might want me to agree with them just based on authority. Saul Pfefferman says that's a beautiful proof, so it must be a beautiful proof. But it's just a reaction that only mathematicians can have.
I wouldn't deny that seeing the beauty in some things takes special perceptual skills, right? And I don't think perception is just the world rushing in on you. It's you got to have skills of seeing, skills of looking, skills of hearing, and you can acquire those things. But then they can be either rightly deployed or not rightly deployed, and you can see what's in the thing or not see what's in the thing.
Oh, Ken, hold it a minute. Do you think about that? Do you think that the world would be a better place if we were all in agreement about what we find beautiful and what we didn't?
Well, I don't know.
But that's a serious question, I think, because compare it with truth, for example.
Yeah.
For any idea, any sentence and proposition, whatever it is that I consider true, I think it's crucial that everyone agree with me on it. If I'm right, if I'm not right, I'd like to agree with those who are right. On the other hand, the idea that you can, say, even somebody I admire and respect as much as I admire and respect you, the idea that you and I would agree on everything that is beautiful and isn't, frankly, I find that a really frightening possibility.
Well, I hope that's not
nothing personal.
Yeah, right. But Alexander, I take your point. I don't think there's a demand like there is a demand for truth. I'm not even sure about truth. Let me take that back. Look, there's convergence in our beliefs about lots of things. There's the possibility of convergence. And sometimes we think that convergence can be rationally managed, you know, through argument and deliberation and experiment or something. We can say, oh, yeah, that's how it is.
Right.
I don't think there are beauty subject to the same kind of pressure to convergence, or we don't have the same methods of trying to make convergence happen. We don't have the wherewithal. All I can do is get you to look. And if you look and don't see it the way I see it, well, then I don't know what happens. I mean,
but that's the issue. What does happen? If somebody agrees with you every time that you point something beautiful to them, if they did, I think you'll end up with two copies of one another. It's a rather frightening idea. You see, I think not only does beauty not converge, I think there's pressure not to converge when it comes to beauty, because what we find beautiful expresses our individuality, our personal taste, who we are. I think that's a very important value.
Well, I think that's true, too. It's like I said, it's a difference between the taste, whether you like lima beans or not. That doesn't say anything about you. When I find a movie, I don't know that I like the word beautiful. I'll come back to that in a minute. But when I find a movie good, engaging, of aesthetic value, I do expect to be able, if not to convince others, at least to get them to see that I do see something in it. People a lot different from me, I don't expect to quite grasp what they're getting at in the things they like, and I don't expect them to grasp me.
So let me ask you both a question, since you have similar views. It seems, can I figure out anything about you from our disagreements about what's beautiful? You say, oh, he loves Picasso paintings. He thinks they're beautiful. And I think, oh, they're kind of mediocre. I don't really think that. I think they're kind of mediocre and moderately interesting, except for maybe, I don't know, the Blue Period or something. What am I supposed to, what does that show about you? You said it's an individual thing and it expresses you. Can I read you by reading what you find beautiful somehow?
Well, if you know a lot about it, you can. If you just know that I like Picasso, that's not very interesting. That's like knowing that I'm, you know, say 5'10". And, you know, how much do you know about me by knowing that?
Yeah.
It's even less than that.
We know but you don't play center for a very good basketball player.
But, fair enough. There is one short player, but anyway. And, but you know something, but not very important. Not something very important about me.
Do you know something about yourself by knowing that you like Picasso?
Well, something distinct from my knowing that I like Picasso?
Yeah, right.
Well, why should I? Why should I know something...
Well, why do you think? I'm just trying to figure out what is this individual thing that you think is expressed by my engagement with this thing that I find beautiful that nobody else? Is that something I can read, that I can self-read, that others can read?
First of all, it's never an issue of one particular thing that you like, I think. It has to do, or find beautiful, it has to do with a whole variety of things and how they're related to one another. And I think the things that we find beautiful, if they're related to one another in an interesting way, and of course there's very little that I can say generally about what's interesting, constitute your style. And style, namely a mode of being in the world and a mode of acting that is characteristically your own, is something that notoriously is very difficult to describe, right? I mean, style is something that you have to be acquainted with. I can't describe to you the style of Beethoven. I can tell you some general things, but nothing that I tell you is going to be really illuminating, again, as John was saying before, on the basis of Kant, that no matter how many concepts or descriptions I use of a particular object, you will never be able to either infer from that description that it is beautiful or not beautiful, or that you will like it.
I see. I see, Alexander. You know what? Polly in San Francisco has a question, I think, along these lines. Polly, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
What's your comment or question?
You sort of addressed it. I mean, I'm interested in the difference between, or the convergence even between beauty and taste. I mean, I suppose taste has some relation to education, and it's a sort of a socioeconomic thing, and it's a cultural thing because, you know, when you're talking about liking or not liking Picasso, I mean, I understand that you have to sort of break it down. What do you mean by Picasso? That's an enormous, you know, body of work. But I think it does take a certain sort of a degree of education or I'm not sure where I'm going.
Yeah, well, thanks. Let's see if Alexander or John can
admit. But I think it's a sort of a socioeconomic, cultural...
Let me follow up, though, a little with you, Polly. I mean, do you think that people that have a similar education will agree about what's beautiful? I mean, do you think... is it more negative? If they don't have a certain amount of education, they're not going to like Picasso. But does it follow that if they do have a certain amount of education or similar education, they'll agree? I mean, where do you expect agreement?
I think we've lost Polly.
Okay.
Well, Alexander, what do you think?
Well, I think that Polly is absolutely right, that there are definite social and economic factors in the kind of taste that people have. But that's true of everything about us. Everything about us that's social has that involves socialization, like taste, which involves other things and other people, will have social and economic factors going into making it and being responsible for it. But that still leaves a tremendous, tremendous area in which people can differ from one another.
Yeah.
Now, if you've never been exposed to modern art, you'll find it very difficult to like any of it. But you can get to like it.
So what happens when people argue then? I mean, I have to admit I'm not a great Picasso admirer. And my friends with better taste or whatever often try to argue me into saying, oh, yes, it's really pretty good. What's going on there? What is the interaction? It's not just a straightforward logical deduction, is it?
No, it's very different, isn't it, actually? That's a very, very good point, John. With works of art, something very different happens from what happens when you have an abstract general argument. You have to have the thing in front of you, one way or the other. I can't just tell you, you know, Picasso is great because some of his paintings are blue. Well, yeah, those are, of course, the ones that Ken doesn't like. But nevertheless, right. Some of his paintings are pink. So nothing that I tell you is going to convince you one way or the other. The best we can do, and the most we can do, is bring ourselves in front of the paintings or reproductions or whatever it is and try to point things out that have attracted us and that still attract us so that we ourselves want to find out more about them and see whether you could look at the painting with let's put it in the first person. I want to see whether you can look at the painting with my eyes, so to speak. It's a very famous story about two ancient painters. One of them painted Aphrodite, and some person said, "Ah, she's totally ugly. She's like a peasant girl." And another great painter said, "If only you could see them with could see her with my eyes, you'd see she's a goddess."
Well, yeah. Stephanie, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stephanie. What do you want to add to this conversation?
Well, I think that one's judgment of what's beautiful is often hinged on their motivation. Like, for instance, in city planning, somebody might really love a building because of its history and architecture, its context in a neighborhood, that sort of thing. Somebody else might say, oh, no, we want to build a gigantic housing complex there, and this thing has lacks integrity. It's falling down. Look at it. It needs a paint job and so on. Depending on the motives.
So, Stephanie, you think that sort of assessments of beauty are somehow self-interested. They're somehow instrumental or something like that.
Well, yes, and it can even extend to something like a mother telling a daughter that she's beautiful and really saying it with great love and the motive being that she wants to give the child confidence. But the girl has a big nose and a wart on her chin.
Thanks,
Stephanie.
Stephanie, you brought up the... you still there, Stephanie?
Yes.
Yeah, you brought up architecture. I think that's very interesting. It's always fascinated me. All these buildings that were built in the 60s, a lot of California's public universities were unfortunately built then. They're so ugly. The buildings are so ugly. Big concrete buildings that are ugly, sometimes adorned with little pieces of blue plastic. Is it possible, and here I'm stepping out of my theory, but I mean, how is it possible that people actually thought those were beautiful? Was it self-deception? Or I mean, is it quite that subjective? How did that happen?
Well, Alexander, what do you think here?
I have something to say about
Thanks,
that.
Stephanie.
That's a very good point. Now, you look around and you say that, especially look around at buildings of the 60s, and you find out that 99.5% of them are horrible, right?
Yeah, I think that's at true. Least.
At least. All right, let's be generous. Now, I think that 99.5% of everything is awful. No matter what it is, 95% of paintings are awful. 99% of novels are awful. 99% of musical compositions are awful. The idea is that with architecture, it's everywhere around us. So we see all of it. Whereas when we talk about music, say, or the novel, we are talking about a minuscule proportion of the totality of novels.
Yeah, that's
namely
a very
the
good...
ones we already have decided are great.
That's a very good point, because compare the architecture of the 60s with the music of the 60s. Probably a lot of the music of the 60s was lousy, but when I listen to my golden oldie station, I don't hear the lousy ones.
It's
but
a goldie.
I still have to, I still have to look at the lousy buildings.
Guys,
that's
I want to address something else that Stephanie said, because I found it intriguing. She said something about contemplation of beauty, the assessments of beauty are somehow self-interested. I think of beauty as something that the contemplation of beauty that somehow disinterested. You see this beautiful thing and it takes you outside yourself, and you're not, and it's intrinsically, well, I don't know about intrinsically, but it commands something from you despite your utilitarian interest in you, or independently of your utilitarian interest in it. I mean, am I just being
naive?
Alexander?
Well, look, I agree with you. But I think we need to pay attention to the fact that beauty has often been used in a self-interested way. In other words, by not forcing people, but by habituating people to consider certain things beautiful and certain things not beautiful, lots of political agendas and other extra beauty institutions have furthered themselves. In other words, beauty does play often an ideological role. And I think part of what Stephanie may have had in mind, I'm not sure, may have been that. And one of the reasons, in fact, that beauty was completely absent, not only from philosophy, but from the art history, from literary criticism in the second half of the 20th century, one of the main reasons was precisely that critics and historians thought that what counted as beautiful was always determined to be beautiful by a power elite, so to speak,
right,
that forwarded its own agenda through it.
Yeah.
And we need to be careful about that, I think.
Ko Yi in San Francisco.
Hello there. It's actually cozy, like cozy fantasy.
Oh, okay. Okay,
cozy. Right.
Great discussion. My feeling is that beauty is very undervalued in our society, and I'm not talking about the beauty of people, because you only have to look at art throughout the ages to know that what we consider in a stylistic way to be beautiful, either in people or in furniture or buildings, changes and is a result of many things. But what I'm calling to talk about is actually the eternal beauties, the beauty that brings tears to our eyes. I was in the park yesterday under a cherry blossom tree, and what I'm curious about is when... I would suggest after this program you go under your nearest blossom tree, look up at the blue sky through those blossoms, and something in you will catch. It's stunning. There is a visceral response if you're halfway awake. Anyway, there is a visceral response.
Well, there's a problem. In the East Coast, we don't have any flowers yet, unfortunately. You know, you in San Francisco are much luckier than we are that way.
But you know what I mean? It's,
yes.
What intrigues me is how humankind, throughout its evolution, certain things, all societies, love color, love flowers, love a sunset. They find that beautiful. They are joined in that appreciation. They then decorate their own bodies with feathers.
Cozy. I take your point, and it's a very good point. And we're going to have to address it in some depth in a little bit. And I'm going to remind our listeners that you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about beauty with Alexander Nehemas of Princeton University.
Coming up, does beauty matter? Is a beautiful mathematical proof better than an unbeautiful one? What would life be like without beauty?
Philosophy Talk. We'll be right back. Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, what many people call a beautiful piece of music. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm Ken Taylor.
I'm John Perry. Join our conversation by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Our toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or from anywhere in the world, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.com.
Our guest is Alexander Nehemas of Princeton University. Alexander, our last caller, Cozy, made a very good point about natural beauty and as opposed to beauty of works of art and architecture, which tends to change from time to time. And I've got a bunch of things in my mind I want to just throw out and have you straighten out. So let me just ask a long, complicated thing that's not really a question. First of all, I seem to remember that philosophers like Hegel and Schopenhauer claim that no natural beauty is as good as a good work of art. Secondly, I seem to remember that they were driven to bring in another term, the sublime, and the beautiful versus the sublime. You don't hear much about that anymore. And thirdly, that raises the question, are we using beautiful as kind of some kind of portmanteau concept for anything of aesthetic value? But really, when I see things that make me happy, it's really something much different than when I hear the Moonlight Sonata. That doesn't make me happy. It arouses emotions, and in that sense, it's beautiful. Can you bring some order to this welter of thoughts?
Certainly a welter, John. Each one of them is a very good thought. Altogether, they are many very good thoughts. Well, let's start with natural beauty. Yes, Kant and Schopenhauer and various other philosophers have thought that natural beauty is not nearly as important or as interesting as the beauty of artifacts, the beauty of artworks, because they believe that in order to find something truly beautiful, you have to discern a mind in it. Accordingly, when you see a work of art, when you read something or when you listen to something, you get in touch, so to speak, with the mind of its composer, its creator. And that's very much where beauty resides for them, or at least that's a serious factor in making things beautiful. Now, about natural beauty, of course, Kant really admired natural beauty immensely, in fact, even more sometimes than the beauty of the arts. But I would like to take some issue with what Cozy said, actually. And I may be myself now in a very difficult position. You know, I am not that moved by the beauty of nature. I mean, I like flowers, all right, but I really don't like trees at all.
Too long trees. On the East Coast, Alexander. Yeah. Yes.
Too many trees on the East Coast, yeah. Maybe, and no horizon. You see, I'd rather have a desert or the sea. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't like nature. I just don't like trees and flowers. I think, of course, people have always, and I think Cozy was absolutely right with that, they've always liked nature, and they've always decorated themselves and their houses and their bodies according to natural motifs, but that's mostly because that's what's mostly around us. That's what.
Not so much anymore.
Well, not so much anymore, but for the largest part of our history, yeah. That's all there was. Okay, so that's one issue, and I think that, you know, there are still differences about what people like in nature and what they don't. That's one point. Another point, John, has to do with happiness and the emotions that you have when you hear the Moonlight Sonata. I agree with you absolutely about that. I don't think beauty and happiness go together in the sense that to see something beautiful makes you happy. I have a formula that I've stolen it from a French author, but I still use it a lot, but I credit him, that beauty is a promise of happiness. It's a promise of happiness. You don't have the happiness when you see the beautiful thing, but you feel that it will bring you happiness if only you can get to it.
I want to press you on that even, though, because I'm not sure about something. I know. People say that beauty gives, the contemplation of beauty gives you pleasure. Or maybe it's the promise of pleasure if you contemplate it long enough and deeply enough and it's inexhaustible source. But, you know, lots of beautiful, I don't know, lots of powerful things, aesthetically powerful things can be depressing. There's this movie that I love, Requiem for a Dream. It's about the psychology of drug addiction. It's relentless. It's a relentless piece of filmmaking. It takes you down into the depths of the psychology of these drug addicts, and it never gives you a breath of fresh air. It never gives you any hope, and it just shows you the destruction of their dreams. It does it powerfully. Now, I guess I was pleased to have seen the movie, but I wasn't pleased in seeing the movie, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What is that? Is that beauty? This thing that can take you and arrest you and move you to places that shows you the dark side of life.
Where's the promise of happiness even?
Yeah.
Well, let me use your own words, Ken. You said this is a terribly depressing movie that you love. I think that's where the beauty is. The beauty of the movie is in the fact that you love it. And the fact that you love it, I think, is not just a matter of how you feel about it, but the fact that you see it. I assume you've seen it more than once. That you bring it up in your discussions, that you use it as an example, that you think in its terms, that you perceive drug addiction in terms of what you've learned from that movie. It's become a part of your life.
Yeah.
And it's a continuing part of your life. You, in other words, you have not yet exhausted what it has to give you. And that, I think, is crucial. Because once you exhaust what an object, or a person for that matter, has to give you, you then become indifferent. And that's the end, both of it, love and of beauty.
Let's ask you a quick question, Alexander. If I wanted to appear more educated and cultured than I am...
How could that be?
I would use the word sublime, but I have no idea what philosophers are getting at with sublime. What's sublime?
That was your second question, and I forgot it because I am a great enemy of the sublime.
Oh, good.
I despise the sublime, actually, more than trees, even.
Alexander, we are learning a lot about you today.
And I am about 5'10", you know, maybe 11. But anyway, look, the sublime is supposedly, I think, it's a feeling that we have when an object is so vast, so powerful, so overpowering, that we feel completely obliterated in its presence. But this feeling of obliteration does not necessarily bring real fear or real the desire to run away or whatever. You still sit there looking at it and trying to understand what it is in its grandness, what the tsunami wave is when it just takes everything along, whether they are human beings, buildings, beaches, whatever it is.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so, okay. So much for the sublime.
We've got a lineup of callers here. I'm going to try and get a fair number of callers in here. So callers, be relatively brief, please. Bob and Elsa Bronte, welcome to Philosophy Talk. Bob.
Well, thank you. I'm really enjoying this conversation, and there was talk of beauty being the anticipation of pleasure in the future. I'd like to suggest that for me these days, it's the memory of pleasure, in particular in my marriage and, you know, when my wife and I were much more physically beautiful, it was different. And now it's I wouldn't trade that youthful physical beauty for what we have for anything, you know.
Thanks for that
good
comment.
Good point.
Ed in Berkeley, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ed.
Wow, I thought he was going to talk a little longer.
Okay, well, you're on, Ed.
Beauty is truth and truth is beauty, and something about a joy forever. Is it Keats or Shelley?
It's Keats.
Keats, yeah. Didn't in the old times they had these verities, you know, goodness, truth, and beauty? In terms of, I'm going to, well, what do you want? The truth, you're saying you can, there is a truth, there is a, you know. But I think finding truth is kind of hard, like quantum mechanics. Not everybody agrees. And then beauty, on the other hand, you have this whole industry. Well, you have the fine art in this way, industry, fine arts anyway, are always trying to extend and stretch our concept of beauty.
Yeah, well, thank you, Ed.
Very good point, Bob. I mean, if truth is beauty and beauty is truth, you wouldn't expect the industries around it to be so different. I think that saying is a little bit like the saying on the, you know, every Stanford classroom has no drink or food. Well, it's obviously false. There's drink or food in all the classrooms, right?
Yeah.
And truth is beauty and beauty truth. It sounds nice, but it's just obviously false.
Tim in San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Tim.
Hi, thanks. I just really wanted to kind of posit that perhaps in terms of shared tastes and style, perhaps beauty is kind of like human marketing in that at different times people can convince others that something is beautiful. For instance, the buildings of the 60s or bell bottoms, which have gone in and out. And those things kind of change over time, and it's almost like the right idea at the right time can become what is beautiful, such as Picasso in some point periods and maybe not in other periods. So I think that's how it can kind of change over time. That's what I would kind of submit in that realm.
Thanks, Tim. Alexander, there's a lot of different stuff going on here, but I want to just ask you something about, you said something about nature, and we've always liked nature, and some people have been fond of nature and others aren't. Again, what all these different varieties of beauty, is it that you think that what they have in common is this anticipation of happiness, this promise of happiness, as you put it? Is that the common thing that makes all beautiful things beautiful?
Well, for me, it is. And in a way, in this case, I go back not just to Kant. I go much farther back. I go back to Plato. And Plato thought of beauty as what love is of, the object of love. And I think that's how I would understand beauty. And the idea of a promise of happiness is a gloss on beauty being the object of love. And I think to a very great extent, the original, your roving reporter's report actually suggested something like that, because if you remember what the people said, everything they mentioned, they were so different, but everybody was expressing an attitude that in one degree or another, not always exactly the same degree, was involved, I think, an expression of love. And I think that's really quite essential to it.
I really think that, I believe it was Bob made the point about memory. I really think that's an important point, and it's emotional memory, right? I mean, something that's beautiful, or at least has great aesthetic value. Maybe we wouldn't call it beautiful like Ken's movie, but it really gets down and it creates an emotion in you, and then it brings up the memories of events that have provoked that emotion, or in some cases should have at the time but didn't.
Yeah.
And you release the tears or the joy or the happiness. It's very complicated.
I'm going to ask you, I'm going to shift topics briefly. We're getting toward the end of our time, but I'm going to shift topics just briefly. We've kind of touched on it, you know, but I want to ask the question, why does beauty matter? I mean, to a life. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I lived a life full of, you know, wealth and others, and with wealth and engagement in politics or whatever, would the absence of beauty make my life significantly worse? I mean, is beauty just a frill to a life, or is it a deep thing?
I think it's very deep, and I think that even if you live a life full of money and power or whatever, you still are involved in beauty. You can't avoid it. It's about as basic to human nature, if there is such a thing as human nature, as anything we have. And ultimately, what beauty is, I think, it's a very difficult thing to say, but what we consider beautiful, the things that we find beautiful in life, are essential to making us individuals, to making us different from others, not in a way that makes us incapable of interacting with other people, but it gives us our own stamp. And I think the desire for individuality, as of course John Stuart Mill so clearly expressed in many, many, many of his works, both on liberty and his autobiography and everywhere else, is absolutely essential to human beings. There are two kinds of values, as I see it, to put it very brusquely. Moral values, which depend on the fact that there are deep similarities and identities among people, and which require us to treat each other with impartiality and equally with respect. And aesthetic values, which depend on the fact that on top of all our similarities, we all have the ability, at least, of being different and, as I said before, putting our own stamp on our own lives.
Our own style. Alexander, that's. I wish we had more time to talk about that.
So do
that's,
I.
That's deep stuff, but I want to thank you for joining us. Our guest has been Alexander Naamas of Princeton University. He's the author of The Art of Living, Socratic Reflections from Plato to Foucault, a great book, by the way, which I highly recommend to you. Alexander, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ken and John. That was a very nice hour.
Thanks, Alexander. And next time you're out in Palo Alto, we're going to lie down under a big redwood tree, and we're going to talk about it until you admit it's damn beautiful.
Okay, John, you're on.
Now, you know, you could. There's more of this conversation, by the way. Alexander has agreed to blog for us as a guest blogger, so you can hear more of Alexander's, read more of Alexander's thoughts, and offer comments by going to our blog at www.theblog.philosophytalk.org. But John, what did we learn today?
I mean, you know, I did a little preparation for this show because I, as always, I know so little about the field we call aesthetics and the philosophy of art. And through that whole experience, and especially talking to you and Alexander that know a lot more about it, I've learned it's quite a fascinating area.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, actually, it dropped out of philosophical concern for a long time, especially the topic of beauty. Philosophers, I guess, thought they had more important things to do, wonder about morality, truth, But beauty's made a big comeback. There's lots of stuff about beauty now that you can read, and if you go to our blog, you'll learn some of this stuff. It's a great topic, and Alexander's a great writer on this stuff.
And I was impressed with how many of the traditional themes of philosophy in other areas, in the philosophy of perception, the philosophy of knowledge, morality, come up within aesthetics. The whole issue of subjectivity, intersubjectivity. The complexity of understanding what goes on in communication and argument, It's a fascinating field, and I'm glad that it's back on the philosophical map, thanks to Alexander and other people like him.
So now that we've got beauty on the map, that's it for today. Thanks to all those who call in. We apologize to those we didn't get a chance to speak to. As I said before, the conversation continues on our brand new, spanking brand new blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Dave Fusaro, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association and from various groups at Stanford University.
And even more support from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and from the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.